Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist, Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me for the 200th episode of the Deathcast. This time through, we're covering a case that was voted on by the supporters over at tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early and ad-free shows, exclusive content, as well as vote on cases that we are going to cover. Now, this week's case is very well known. It's been covered by everybody, but the Patreon members wanted to hear me deep dive on it. So this week, we're going to be taking a look at Jeffrey Dahmer, easily the most infamous serial killer of the last half century. Now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. So we all know the Jeffrey Dahmer story. It's something that has been told again and again in various forms of media. Knowing that the 200th episode of the show was coming up, I put it to my Patreon members to select the next case. I gave them three options, and Jeffrey Dahmer was the overwhelming winner. So, for this 200th episode, we are going to be diving into the life and crimes of Jeffrey Lionel Dahmer. And Jeffrey Dahmer is a unique case in that I can remember them breaking in on the news to announce that a man had been arrested in Milwaukee and that police were pulling body parts out of his apartment. Now, Dahmer wasn't the first serial killer who I'd heard of. That particular distinction, in fact, goes to Ted Bundy. I can remember when Bundy was put to death and my mother explaining to me who he was, just as I can remember when John Wayne Gacy was put to death and they made an absolutely terrifying made-for-TV movie about him, starring Brian Dennehy as Gacy, called To Catch a Killer, which, if you've never seen it, I highly recommend you go out and look for. Dahmer was different because it was really the first serial killer in modern times that got the type of nationwide attention that we have come here in the 21st century to know and expect. Everyone, from school children to late-night talk show hosts, were talking about Jeffrey Dahmer. In fact, I remember a joke from back then, one of many, many jokes that was made concerning Dahmer, about officers finding a pair of testicles inside of his refrigerator, and one of them saying to him, "Why do you have a pair of testicles in your refrigerator?" Dahmer replying, "Well, sometimes I feel like a nut, sometimes I don't." An obvious reference to the Mounds and Almond Joy commercials that were popular during this period of time. Jeffrey Dahmer was a sensationalistic newsman's wet dream come true. His case, his life, had every single thing that a reporter could want and that a population hungry for blood and guts craved. So we're going to go through the case of Dahmer, beginning with his arrest. At approximately 11:30 p.m. on July 22nd, 1991, a half-dressed man with a handcuff on one wrist flagged down two Milwaukee police officers in their cruiser. This was officers Robert Roth and Rolf Mueller at the corner of North 25th Street and informed them that a man living in apartment 213 of the Oxford Apartments had placed the handcuff on him and threatened to kill him with a knife. This man was 32-year-old Tracy Edwards. Edwards told the officers that the man was a freak. He asked them if they could remove the handcuff, and when the officers were unable to do so, he agreed to return to the apartment with the officers to see if they could get the key. He told the two officers that he had been in the apartment with the man for over 5 hours. Getting to the second floor of the apartment building, officers noted that there was a foul stench in the air, and upon knocking on apartment 213, they were greeted by Jeffrey Dahmer, who informed the officers that he had, in fact, put the handcuff on Edwards' wrist. However, he gave no explanation as to why he had done this. Officers came inside of the apartment and would later state that they immediately recognized the grisly stench of death, that is, human decomposition, present inside of the apartment. Reminding the officers about the keys that he needed to get the handcuff off, one of the officers made towards Dahmer's bedroom, where Edwards stated the key was inside the dresser drawer. Dahmer attempted to intercept the officer and was informed that he needed to quote-unquote back off. Upon entering the bedroom, the officer noticed a very large knife lying on the floor beside the bed, and inside of the dresser door, scores of Polaroid pictures depicting men in various states of undress and dismemberment. The officer, Mueller, looked at these photographs and very quickly realized that the backgrounds of the photographs matched the apartment that he was currently standing in. Taking the photographs, Mueller walked into the living room, showing them to his partner and supposedly stating, "These are for real." Apparently, seeing that the officers had his photographs, Dahmer then became resistant to them and attempted to fight with them. However, he was quickly subdued, letting out a scream as they handcuffed him on the floor. At this point, the officers radioed for backup, and a second squad car was quickly dispatched to the Oxford Apartments. Officer Mueller then began looking around the apartment, and upon opening the refrigerator, he saw a severed human head sitting on the bottom shelf. Now, according to both officers, at this point, Dahmer looked at both of them and said, quote, "For what I did, I should be dead." Now, obviously, the officers are horrified by this discovery. They quickly relay this information to police headquarters, and a whole squad of detectives and crime scene investigators are dispatched to apartment 213. Now, the severed head was a startling and disturbing discovery. What they are going to find in the rest of the apartment, however, is just as ghastly. A total of 4 severed heads is going to be found inside of the kitchen. 7 skulls, some of them painted, some of them bleached, were found in both Dahmer's bedroom as well as inside of a closet inside the apartment. There was also a tray filled with blood drippings inside of Dahmer's refrigerator. 2 human hearts and a section of arm muscle, each which had been wrapped up inside of its own plastic bag. Inside of the freezer and torso was discovered, bags of human organs, and later, once it had thawed out, bits of human flesh that had been stuck to the ice in the bottom of the freezer. But this is not all that is found in Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment. There are two fully denuded to the bone skeletons, pair of severed hands, two penises which had been severed and preserved, a mummified scalp, drawings of a temple made of human bones that Dahmer was dreaming of construction, and also a 57-gallon drum of acid. This is a very famous drum. There's pictures of it all over the internet of firefighters in hazmat suits removing this drum, inside of which were three partially dissolved human torsos. There were numerous other objects found inside of the apartment, such as an electric drill, various amounts of beer, and pills, which Dahmer would later confess to using to drug his victims once he got them back to his apartment. Now, this was all over the news almost immediately. I was living in New Jersey at the time of Jeffrey Dahmer's arrest, and this was on the 11 o'clock news that night. They didn't have much information on it other than the fact that a man had been arrested for multiple murders, human body parts had been found inside of his house. However, the next day was when the deluge of information concerning Jeffrey Dahmer began. As in the early morning hours of July 23rd, 1991, after having been brought to the police station, Jeffrey Lionel Dahmer began confessing to the officers, after being read his Miranda rights, all of the various things that he had done, all of his crimes. But more than that, he started telling them really his life story. So that is where we are going to go next, looking at who Jeffrey Lionel Dahmer was. Jeffrey Lionel Dahmer was born on May 21st, 1960, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the son of Lionel Herbert Dahmer, who at the time was a chemistry student at Marquette University, and Joyce Annette Dahmer, who at this point in time was working as a teletype machine instructor. If you don't know what the teletype was, it was the precursor to fax machines. Joyce was said to be very self-centered, attention needing, to have a series of emotional and physical ailments, but also to be a hypochondriac. Some records indicate that at the time that she was pregnant with Jeffrey, she was taking as many as 26 different pills a day to deal with all of these various maladies. According to the family, that during much of her pregnancy, Joyce suffered an unexplained rigidity of body, meaning she really couldn't move that much. Her joints were stiff. Her whole posture was stiff. There are various accounts of Dahmer's childhood. Some state that his parents doted on him, while other accounts have it that the parents largely ignored the young newborn in their family, as his father was extremely involved with his studies and his mother was constantly seeking her husband's attention when he was home. There are stories that Joyce was extremely combative with both the neighbors as well as with her husband. At some point during his early years, Joyce Dahmer attempted suicide using a minor tranquilizer, meprobamate, known under the brand names of Miltown and Equinil. whether or not this was a serious suicide attempt or simply an attempt on Joyce's part to get sympathy and attention for others is left up to the listener. Jeff's family, particularly his father, was devoutly religious. Before the time Jeff was 2 years old, he had learned his first prayer. Not long after this, his father completed his master's degree and was accepted to Iowa State University, where he undertook postgraduate work towards a doctorate in philosophy. This entailed the family moving to Iowa, specifically in Ames. It has been noted by family members that from almost the point he was born, Jeffrey Dahmer seemed to be fascinated by other living beings. At this stage in his life, it was small animals and insects. Joyce stated that when Jeff started preschool, he was a very shy, reserved child. And later, investigators have come to the conclusion that more likely than not, Dahmer felt instantly out of place inside of a structured school environment. Although he was still said to be somewhat energetic, this changed on March 19th of 1964 when Jeff underwent double hernia surgery. And some have speculated that this operation, in which, as he later told interviewers, he wondered if his genitals had been cut off, as well as his fascination with other living creatures, may have played a part in Jeff's burgeoning psyche. We know that at age 5, although still painfully shy to the point that at times he would cry about having to go to school, Joyce enrolled Jeffrey in a local grade school, which he had to ride a bus to attend with other children from the neighborhood. There are stories from this period of time of Dahmer playing with the other boys in the neighborhood. We know that Dahmer, during this period of time, got into the normal mischief of other young boys, throwing rocks through the windows of derelict houses and cars, things of that nature. At least on one occasion, the police arrived at the Dahmer household to tell his parents, who were ashamed of his actions, that he had gotten into trouble for busting out the windows on a house. Both parents were adamant over the fact that while Jeff was reprimanded for his actions, he was not physically harmed or punished in any way. We also know that during this point in time, Dahmer had his first encounter with a dead animal. By his own recollection, he was under the crawl space to the house when he came across some bones. Something about them absolutely fascinated them. Dahmer began calling them his fiddlesticks and would play with them for hours on end when he was on his own. He later stated that after finding these bones, whenever he would hold an animal, be it one of the family's pets, or something that he had found out in the neighborhood, he could feel their quote-unquote fiddlesticks moving inside of their bodies, and he began to wonder whether or not the bones inside of these animals were the same or similar to the ones that he had discovered underneath the family's home. All of this going on, life inside the Dahmer home is getting worse. His father is constantly working. His mother is getting more dependent on pills and becoming more demanding for attention. Jeffrey later stated that he saw his father strike his mother on a number of occasions when she became so worked up that he was unable to calm her down using his normal means. Unfortunately, this type of thing was very common during this point in time, the early to mid-1960s, where a husband would strike his wife, be it because she needed to be quote-unquote disciplined, or, you know, because the husband believed that she was overreacting, whatever the case may be. You have to imagine, though, that seeing this type of thing as a young child had another adverse effect on young Jeffrey Dahmer. He did state in interviews that it was during this point in time that he began to feel a sense of instability inside of the family home. Teachers from this point in time made notes that they felt that Jeffrey felt neglected at home. Joyce Dahmer ends up turning to religion, namely the Church of Christ, something that her husband easily acquiesced to, and the two of them were baptized in this religion in 1966. She also decided that the thing that was missing in her life was another child. Very quickly, Joyce Dahmer was pregnant again. Later on in that year, Lionel Dahmer ends up getting his doctorate, and he lands a job as a research chemist with the Pittsburgh Plate and Glass Company in Ohio. Jeffrey Dahmer is forced at this point to give up all of his pets, which, while there is no written record that this bothered him to any great degree, knowing the things that we know about him and that we know about serial killers, this is more likely than not another episode in his young life of feeling abandoned, being forced to give up the things that give him joy and keep him company inside of this hectic, extremely dysfunctional household. Now, the family ends up moving to Doylestown, Ohio in October of 1966. And in December of that year, specifically on the 18th, Jeffrey's younger brother, David, is born. Now, according to Lionel Dahmer, Joyce was extremely depressed prior to the pregnancy and continued this depression afterwards. In addition to all of this, Jeff ends up getting another dog for Christmas. So, despite the fact that his father's never home, his mother is more often than not zonked out of her mind on pills in between bouts of demanding attention from her husband. Jeff is splitting his time between school, playing with the new family dog, tending to his brother David, and exploring their new surroundings. Not long after the new year, Joyce begins to complain about the neighbors, stating that they are too loud, she cannot rest peacefully, etc., etc., something that she had been doing almost since the moment that she and Lionel were married. Lionel decides that they're gonna move. This is a pattern in their marriage. He basically always rolls over for his wife, giving in to her wants as opposed to starting a fight with her. So the family moves to Barberton, Ohio. According to Jeff, shortly after moving to Barberton, he and a group of boys in the neighborhood were horseplaying around. One of them suggested that they should try and choke one another to see what it was like. Jeff ends up doing this to one of the other boys, and the boy immediately goes and tells the teacher, which leads to Dahmer receiving 10 strikes from a paddle. Dahmer stated years after the fact that when this happened, as the boy had promised he would not tell on him, Jeffrey felt betrayed. Something that he stated he did not feel when he was playing with his animals. There was also an incident where Dahmer recounted that he had given his teacher tadpoles, and the teacher had seemed very pleased with them until a few days later when he noticed that they were not in their accustomed spot on the windowsill in the classroom. That afternoon, when he went over to a classmate's house to play, he discovered that the teacher had given the tadpoles to this other student, and Jeffrey again feels betrayed, deciding to pour motor oil into the tank containing them, thus killing them. As Dahmer later stated, his mindset was, if she cannot have them or does not want them, then nobody else can have them. This is the first known instance, by the way, of Jeffrey Dahmer killing another living creature. But obviously, it would not be his last. In fact, it's only just the beginning of his more violent tendencies, although, as you're going to see, it's not going to take a whole lot for Jeffrey to begin becoming barbaric to other creatures. Lionel had taken to driving the family around the rural countryside on Sundays as a way to really, you know, spend time with the family, but also to help pacify his wife Joyce, who was house-ridden by this point. And it was on one of these Sunday excursions that the Dahmers chanced to drive through the town of Bath, Ohio. Passing by a home that was for sale, Joyce instantly fell in love with the place, and very quickly the Dahmer family purchased it and moved to Bath. So yet again, we have young Jeffrey Dahmer already feeling inadequate, suffering from undiagnosed forms of psychosis, being forced to move yet again. This house is going to become fairly significant in the Jeffrey Dahmer story. Although he later stated that upon purchasing this house that was in the woods with a pond nearby, he felt inside that there might be a chance for some stability inside of the family. Jeff quickly fell in love with the property. His father built a chicken coop so that they could raise their own chickens and have farm fresh eggs, something that Jeff found to be fascinating. It was also been stated that Jeff helped to take care of sheep and goats in the surrounding fields that belonged to their neighbors. Jeff made friends with the local children, although his father, Lionel, did note somewhat anxiously that it appeared that outside of the animals, Jeffrey took no interest in anything. Moving into junior high school, Jeff was the same as he always had been, making some friends but really not getting close to anyone. He takes up an instrument in the school band, although as with many things in Jeff's life, he only shows interest in it for a very short period of time before his interest wanes and he simply gives it up. This too is something that Jeff is going to make a habitual habit of, this getting involved in something, showing interest in a particular subject before losing interest and dropping it entirely. Friends that Jeff made at school would later state that he was quote-unquote a smart kid, but really bizarre, nice, quiet, and reserved, unquote. But nobody really understood just how odd Jeffrey was becoming. Even his father, who realized his son was gaining an interest in biology, was unaware. We'll be back in just a moment. You've heard me talk about it before, peeps and freaks. Chinese Mandarin is the number one in-demand language globally in the international job market. And I have a brand new sponsor this week just for you. Chinese teacher Mary. Mary goes deep into learning Mandarin, much the same way I go deep into covering true crime cases, ensuring that every single student not only understands pronunciation and sentence structure, but that they can differentiate between tones, read the language, and speak it fluently. I have never come across another Chinese teacher quite like Mary, because while she likes to have fun, and believe me, Mary is absolutely hilarious, she takes the job of teaching foreigners Chinese extremely seriously. So what I want you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary, follow her, subscribe to her, come to her class, which is held 3 times a day. Support her and learn from her. Because I can almost guarantee you that after one lesson with Mary, you're going to realize that there is not a single teacher out there who is as dedicated to teaching as she is. Again, that's tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary. Or just look for the link in the description. Hey there, D&Ders, your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week. Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. At this point, Jeffrey Dahmer is roughly 9 years old, and by both his and his father's accounts, the family during this point made every effort that they could to eat dinner together on a nightly basis. And on one evening, as they were eating chicken, Jeffrey happened to ask his father what would happen if they took the chicken bones that were left over after they finished eating, and they were to place those bones into bleach. Lionel, obviously sensing some kind of a connection to his son, in that his son was showing an interest in science, decided that he would teach Jeffrey how to bleach animal bones. The significance of this moment in time cannot really be understated, as Jeffrey had a very deep fascination with the inner workings of animals, something that was really unbeknownst to anyone save himself. This, coupled with his parents' fighting, which was becoming increasingly more frequent and volatile, led Jeff to further withdraw into himself. Now, these fights that I'm talking about, according to both Jeff and his brother, as the years had gone on since his brother's birth, his mother had become more and more sullen, had taken to spending more time in bed, doped out of her mind on drugs, and that there was an air of tension in the house that could suddenly erupt out of nowhere with his mother screaming at Lionel and throwing objects at him. This ends up culminating in Joyce being taken to a hospital where she is committed for a month in the mental ward, after which she goes through 22 sessions of psychotherapy. According to Jeffrey, he blamed himself for his mother's illness, although he never verbalized this to anyone as he feared that doing so would cause his mother to spiral further into her mental illness. His brother stated, quote, "He never learned to be open with his feelings of frustration. He went out to the forest by himself and cut down trees for firewood." The truth of the matter is, however, that Dahmer felt as though he did not belong, even at this early age of, 9, 10 years old. He felt as though he was not a part of the family, almost as though he were an alien living among humans. Part of this is all of the things that is going on in the house. There are other indications, too, that he himself was suffering from mental illness, particularly a mild form of schizophrenia. But there were other things at play inside of Jeffrey Dahmer's head that he would never share with another human being. At this point in time, Jeffrey is starting to go through puberty, and while other young boys are thinking about young girls, kissing them, etc., etc., Jeff finds himself unattracted to women. According to Dahmer, when he was around 10 years old, a neighborhood boy who was a few years younger than him had initiated touching and kissing with Jeffrey. And they did this on a number of occasions until fear of being discovered doing this caused them to cease this activity, which is understandable given the time period we're talking about, the early 1970s. Homosexuality in any form was looked down upon by society, and in many places it was actually illegal. And coming from an extremely religious family, it's almost certain that if Jesh should have told his parents that he was not interested in women, they very likely could have sent him for counseling or, had the minister at their church have a talk with him. There's even the possibility that they may have sent Jeff away for, conversion therapy, if such a thing as that had existed at that point in time. The point is, inside, he was different from those around him, and he had no outlet in which to express this, except in his various secret fantasies, wherein he began to explore the bodies of animals and bugs, dissecting them, looking at their innermost secrets, something that he began to derive pleasure from, keeping their various body parts, preserving them as best he could, particularly their bones, which aroused a sexual feeling in Jeffrey that he knew was both not normal and disturbing, but at the same time he felt compelled to pursue and helpless to do anything about. So Jeff keeps it secret, as he does many things about what he is doing. He keeps secret from his parents the fact that he has begun drinking, and that it's through this drinking that he begins to lose his inhibitions to lose this sense of not fitting in, of not being normal, and to express, really for the first time, anything even remotely resembling a personality. This budding personality, which friends in high school would later state was a class clown, was completely different from the Jeffrey Dahmer that they had known in the years prior. He was known to do random things such as begin bleeding like a sheep or clucking like a chicken in class out of nowhere, or one of the things that is most talked about is throwing himself on the ground and faking an epileptic seizure, rolling across the ground for everyone to see. He did a lot of things like this. These weird, strange behaviors, almost mimicking his mother's dire need for attention, although the way Jeffrey chose to do it was so far out of the norm, his friends considered it rather charming, if not unusual. Now, a number of teachers who had Jeffrey in school have all stated that they saw his aloofness, the fact that he was not really attached to anyone or anything, and were alarmed by it. However, no one did anything. No one said anything. They simply allowed Jeffrey Dahmer to be. In fact, the only thing that Jeff really seemed to take any sort of interest in was biology class, where they would do things like dissect piglets and sheep's brains, frogs, and hearts. At this point, Jeff was becoming very adept at dissecting animals due to his own research, so much so that he began keeping animal bodies, specifically skeletons, which he had bleached, of dead animals inside a hut beside the bathhouse road, where the few friends that Jeff had knew they could almost always find him, as began spending an increasing amount of time inside of this structure, which also contained insects that had been preserved in formaldehyde, a moth collection, as well as on the outskirts, a graveyard of animals. Jeff had made crosses for them and had festooned these crosses with the actual skulls of the animals that were buried beneath. Brother David recalls at one point that Jeffrey was so excited to show him things that he was learning in biology class that he actually dissected a mole for his brother to witness. And that was one of the few times he actually saw Jeff really animated, as he removed the organs and placed them each into its own small jar of formaldehyde. One of Jeff's most prized possessions during this point in time was the skull of a pig, which they had dissected in class, in which he had been able to get the teacher to let him bring home, wherein Jeff had denuded it of flesh before bleaching the skull. Now, in today's society, activities like this would be seen as extremely distressing. This point, the early to mid-1970s, however, with a child like Jeffrey Dahmer, who is showing no interest in anything, those around him, particularly his father Lionel and his teachers in school, saw a spark of hope, thinking that maybe Jeffrey would pursue a career in biology. But what they didn't know was that Jeff's interest in dead things went well beyond the curiosity and interest of, you know, a young man, young boy who is interested in biology and instead were turning to a morbid fascination. As Jeff began looking actively for dead animals to dissect, to keep, be it in the woods or fields around the family's home or on the side of the road. Should be noted, however, that at least according to Jeffrey Dahmer, he never actively took the life of an animal beyond the tadpoles, in that every animal that he dissected and explored had died from some outside cause that was not himself, be it an illness or, you know, old age or being hit by a car. And he did not care how large or small the animal was. There are stories of Dahmer carrying home the corpses of dead animals like St. Bernard's and leaving the bodies out in the open where the flesh could rot away and he could then have access to the corpses' insides, which it appears his real interest lay. Now, because of all of this, an incident occurs which has become extremely infamous in the story of Jeffrey Dahmer. As the story goes, he found a dog that had died and brought it home, and wanting to see what the insides of this canine looked like, Dahmer decides to cut the body open. After which, he takes a pole and sticks the dog's head on it out in the woods, before putting the dog's body up inside of a tree. A few days or a few weeks after this happened, an individual by the name of Jim Kipple was walking through the woods with his girlfriend and 4-year-old brother when they came upon the body inside of the tree. The intestines of the animal had been pulled out and were wrapped around the tree almost like Christmas garland. Obviously, the trio was disturbed by this discovery. However, Jim decides to tell one of his friends, and the next day this friend goes and takes a photograph of the entire scene, which would become known across the entire world as, after Dahmer is caught, this friend sells the photograph to the media. One interesting thing to note about Jeffrey Dahmer, however, is that while he did all of these things, these dissections of animals, he never did any of it to his own animals when they would pass away, such as his dog Frisky or any of the animals that belonged to their neighbors. For some reason, Dahmer had no interest in exploring any of these animals' insides. It was only animals that were unknown to him that he felt a desire to cut open, explore, and preserve. Again, something he would later show in his serial murders, wherein none of the victims were known to him. They were all strangers to him up until the night that they met Jeffrey Dahmer. As Jeff's school years progress, the few friends he has noticing all of this also notice something else. Jeff is becoming increasingly dependent on alcohol. Anybody who has been a high school student knows the allure of alcohol. You know, kids sneak it, they go to parties, things like that. Dahmer, on the other hand, was drinking while he was at school, while he was at friends' houses. He had taken to carrying a small flask with him, and this starts to alienate the few friends that he actually does have, to the point that they began avoiding him. And it's in this avoidance that Dahmer meets another individual who shares his penchant for drinking. This individual was the local pot dealer at the high school, and he and Dahmer began spending an inordinate amount of time together. However, this friendship had some rocky instances. Dahmer later stated that this individual would find a dog walking across the road and then speed his car up so that he could hit the animal and kill it. Now, it may sound odd that Jeffrey Dahmer did not enjoy this senseless taking of life, but there are a good number of serial killers who view animal lives as having more value than those of actual people, and it appears as though Jeffrey Dahmer falls into this particular subcategory. And Dahmer recounted a tale in which he'd hit a dog at one point, and the dog had run off. Dahmer stated that he could recall the look in the animal's eyes and that it haunted him. Some have speculated that this particular instance was Jeffrey Dahmer's last shred of humanity, and that after this, his downward spiral really began its full ascent. As at this point, Dahmer is 17 years old, has no ambitions for life outside of dissecting animals, getting high, and getting drunk. And to the best of anyone's knowledge in the outside world, has shown no interest whatsoever in the opposite, fairer sex. However, inwardly, Dahmer is beginning to fantasize about sexual encounters with men that often end with him disemboweling them, murdering them, taking their lives, and dissecting them, much in the same way he dissected the bodies of the various animals that he would find. Again, not something that Jeffrey Dahmer is going to share with anyone, because how do you express these types of thoughts to people around you when they're talking about girls and wanting to get into their pants, etc., etc.? Dahmer knew that he was not normal. He knew that there was no earthly way anyone could understand these thoughts, but he was also terrified of the thoughts that were inside of him, at least by his own accounts. And this is further exasperated by the fact that his parents' relationship at this point, at the age of 17, is completely non-existent. Dahmer would later state that during this point in time, the collapse of his parents' marriage, all of these things going on inside of him, the one thing that occurred during this period when he's 17 years old, at least academically, that drew his attention was a visit to a museum where, for the first time, he saw diagrams of the human body cut in two, thus allowing him to see what was inside of another person instead of just imagining it. Dahmer stated that during this period of time, his cycle of masturbation, often common in teenage boys, really picked up in intensity, many times exceeding 3 masturbatory sessions in a day. According to Dahmer, part of this was due to the fact that he had discovered places that sold gay men's magazines, and that he, in discovering these magazines, as well as with his own fantasies, had found a way to release his sexual urges. Dahmer later said that it was not the person in the photographs that he was envisioning, it was the chest and the torso. He did not want to have an intimate partner in the sense that most people want a partner. He wanted an object that he could possess, could admire, could do whatever it is that he wanted to them. At the same time, Dahmer wanted to explore the internal organs of this individual. Again, not as a person, but as an object that he could possess and do with as he wished. He told a story often repeated concerning a jogger that went by the house quite often. Dahmer would see this man jogging, and he found the body attractive and decided that he wanted this man and would have him, to the point that he realized that there was no way this individual would willingly be with him, and Dahmer was not going to ask this man if he would be a willing participant to him. Instead, Dahmer realized that if he were to have this man, he would have to somehow render him unconscious and immobile in order to get him into the house and then do as he pleased with him. So with this in mind, Dahmer waits by the side of the road one day with a baseball bat, intent on putting this fantasy inside of his mind into action. However, it never comes to pass, as the man does not show up that day. When discussing his fantasy life and the crimes that he would later commit, Dahmer said, quote, "I don't know why it started. I don't have any definitive answer on that myself. If I knew the true, real reasons why all this started before it ever did, I wouldn't probably have done any of it." With all of that in mind, we turn to the year of 1978. That's the year that Jeffrey Dahmer is going to turn 18. It is also the year that his life is going to change irrevocably. Just prior, in December of 1977, Lionel and Joyce Dahmer had decided to get divorced. Now, this isn't to say they had not tried to save the marriage. Both of them readily admitted that during the year of 1977, they had actively sought out professional counseling. However, Lionel became uninterested in saving the marriage when Joyce traveled out of state that September to attend her father's funeral, and while there had an extramarital affair. The Dahmers told both of their sons that they were going to get divorced, stating that they wanted to keep it an amicable situation. However, Lionel changed his mind, very possibly because his wife had cheated on him. And roughly a week after this happened, Joyce received a letter in the mail from a lawyer informing her that she had exactly 1 week to move out of the house. However, it was Lionel who ends up moving out of the home, going to the Ohio Motel at 2248 North Cleveland Massillon Road, which was roughly 10 miles as the crow flies from the house on Bath Avenue. The court decides that Miss Dahmer needs to undergo a psychological evaluation, which Lionel is all too willing to help with. He sends the psychiatrist mass amounts of information concerning his wife's mental condition as well as her behaviors. The doctor noted that Joyce, quote, "very severe emotional problems. She is constantly angry, frustrated, and demanding in her interpersonal relationships. She insists on interpreting the motives of all those around her and seems to deny anyone's right to discuss her own behavior as it affects others." It is worth noting that through all of this, while the two of them bickered about who David would go to live with, nobody gave a thought to Jeffrey. Despite the fact that Jeffrey had been disassociating with reality and those around him for many years at this point, he stated in an interview, quote, "maybe I started shutting down during the divorce proceedings. It was my way of shutting out any painful thoughts, just taking an attitude of not caring or pretending not to care, to save myself the pain of what was going on with the divorce. Maybe it started then. That was effective. It worked. You know that Dahmer's alcohol consumption skyrocketed considerably during this period of time, and that he was caught at least once drinking on school grounds, and when confronted by a teacher and told that they would have to report it to the school, Dahmer simply stated that he's having a lot of problems and that the school guidance counselor already knows about it. Now, all of the teachers at the school would later admit that they assumed the problems that Dahmer was going through were related entirely to his parents' divorce. However, we know now that it had nothing to do with his parents' divorce, or if any, very little, and that instead had to do with the thoughts that were going on inside of his mind and the impulses that he was fighting to control. As prom approached, Dahmer, who was as disinterested in going to the prom as he was in attending school, found that the few friends and acquaintances that he had took it upon themselves to get him a date. So, two of these individuals approach a 16-year-old by the name of Bridget Geiger, who agrees to go and be Jeffrey's date provided he does not drink on the evening of the prom. Dahmer shows up at the Geiger house, not wearing a tuxedo, just a run-of-the-mill suit. He's obviously nervous, so much so that the girl's mother ends up having to pin the corsage on her dress, after which they go to an expensive restaurant and then head to the prom, which was held in Akron, Ohio. After arriving, Dahmer promptly disappeared. When he did reappear, he lied, saying that he had not eaten enough at dinner and had gone looking for a McDonald's, although it was obvious to those in attendance that Dahmer had in fact been drinking. Afterwards, they stopped in a bar before proceeding to Bridget's home, where Dahmer dropped her off at 11 p.m., well shy of her 1 a.m. curfew. Bridget stated that he simply shook her hand, thanked her, and then left. As the school year is winding down, Dahmer finds himself increasingly left at the house by himself, as his father is in the hotel. His mother is constantly running to Wisconsin to visit relatives with David in tow. Dahmer stated that during this period of time, the last few weeks of school, the fantasies that he had been fighting to control began to take complete control of him, consuming him entirely. Now, a number of episodes from this period of time give weight to just how out of touch Lionel Dahmer was with his son. Jeff had a group of individuals over at his house where they were going to do a séance, and towards the end of this, Lionel arrived and threw everyone out of the house. Another episode occurred when Jeff's drinking and pot-smoking buddy came over to the house, and a number of items of jewelry went missing, valued at over $1,000, which prompted Lionel to forbid his son from having anyone over at all. The last notable event to occur was when this drug-dealing friend and another individual came over to the house, went out drinking with Jeff, and when they dropped him off, Lionel greeted all of them and told them they were a bad influence and that Jeff wanted nothing to do with them. One friend told Jeff's father that he would rather hear this from Jeff himself. However, Lionel Dahmer refused to allow Jeff to speak to any of them. This gives you an idea of the type of individual that Lionel Dahmer was. I know there's a lot of shit out there that paints him as this rather hapless father who, while he had his own problems and was unattentive, really didn't do anything to ostracize and alienate his son from his peers. I'm sorry, Lionel Dahmer was a piece of shit. That's my personal opinion. I don't care how intelligent he was, what degrees he had, what religious background he was. The guy wanted nothing to do with his children from the time they were born. and was too wrapped up in his own shit to understand the fact that his oldest son, who was going through things that no one had any idea about, needed friends and would not allow him to have those friends. At Jeff's graduation party, Joyce invited Lionel's parents, and without consulting him, it was decided that they would pay for college and that Jeff would attend Ohio State University. In July of 1978, the Dahmer marriage was officially over, with Lionel Dahmer's, quote, gross neglect of duty and extreme cruelty towards his wife. This granted Joyce custody of David, despite the fact that Lionel had rightly proved that she was unfit to take care of either herself or their youngest child. And while Lionel Dahmer was given visitation rights, he was not allowed to go to the home on Bath Road. However, Joyce was not allowed to leave the residence with David for a permanent residence elsewhere without Lionel's written consent. Lionel Dahmer was ordered to pay $400 a month in alimony, $23,500 for her share in the home, at which point she was to vacate the house on Bath Road, as well as one of the family's cars, as well as the various other trappings that happen in a divorce. However, before the divorce was finalized, Joyce ends up packing up the car and taking David with her to Wichita Falls, Wisconsin, to live with her sister, as she stated that she was terrified of Lionel and what he might do. To show you how out of touch with anything Lionel was, during this point in time, he's in a relationship with a woman. This is now in June. He's not allowed at the house. He will not see Jeff, really, barring a few exceptions, until September rolls around. In the meantime, Jeff is in the house by himself. He has a lot of time and nothing to do with it. Dahmer later stated that he spent his time drinking and fantasizing about the jogger he had seen and about what he would like to do to this man. Dahmer later stated that after about a week of this, when he realized these thoughts came upon him multiple times throughout the day, and only receded a little bit after he had masturbated thinking about them, he came to the conclusion that ever since he had been about 14 or 15 years old, his fantasy, his deepest held sexual fantasy, was to have a completely docile partner to whom he could do whatever it was that he wished. Not only that, Dahmer realized that in order to have this, the individual would have to be dead. He stated, too, that prior to all of this, he had begun to have other fantasies along the same lines as those involving the jogger. However, in these fantasies, it was not a jogger, but a hitchhiker who Dahmer would meet, invite back to his home, and then have his way with. On June 18th of 1978, Jeffrey Dahmer contacted his father, Lionel, asking if he could borrow the car. Lionel agrees, gets Jeff. Jeff drops him back off at the hotel, letting him know that he'll bring the car back the following day and that he's on his way to the cinema. Most sources indicate that this was around 5 p.m. That evening. Jeff is driving when he notices a young man bare-chested standing on the side of the road. According to Dahmer, upon seeing the man, he felt his sexual urges arise. After driving past the man and continuing on a ways, he was finally overcome with the compulsion, turned the car back around, and pulled up to this young man, whose name was Stephen Hicks. Hicks was on his way to a rock concert. Dahmer said he really wasn't going that way, but if he wanted to, he could swing by the house with him and have a few beers. Hicks accepts this, and according to Dahmer, as they're driving and talking, Hicks begins talking about women, and Dahmer realizes that any chance at a sexual conquest with this man will never happen willingly. After being greeted by Jeff's dog Frisky, they went inside to Jeff's bedroom, where Jeff offered him some pot. However, Hicks turned this down, instead saying that he would have a beer, so the two of them hung out in Jeff's room drinking. After a few hours of this, Hicks thanks Dahmer and informs him that he needs to be heading out. Dahmer stated that this enraged him, the idea that this newfound individual whose body Dahmer wanted to possess was going to leave. So he goes down into the basement, gets an 18-inch barbell. He said when he came back upstairs, Hicks was still sitting in the chair with his back to him. Dahmer hits Hicks in the head with the barbell. Hicks jumps up. There is a brief fight, and Dahmer hits him again, at which point Hicks collapses to the floor. Dahmer stated that he was overcome with a mixture of panic and excitement, and after a moment's hesitation, Jeffrey Dahmer straddles Stephen Hicks's body, placing the barbell across his throat and pushing down on it until Hicks is no longer breathing. Afterwards, Dahmer removed Hicks's clothing, looked at his body, began to touch it, fondle it, kiss it, before lying down next to him. Eventually, Dahmer stands up and masturbates over Stephen Hicks's corpse. Jeffrey Dahmer later stated, "I was out of my mind with fear that night. I didn't know what to do. I had gone to such an extreme." He ends up dragging Hicks's body outside into the crawl space beneath the house, where he leaves it. Dahmer stated that he did not sleep that night and instead thought about how he could undo what he had just done. Dahmer decided that the only way he could hide his crimes was to completely remove any trace of Stephen Hicks's existence. So the next day he goes and buys a large knife. Going into the crawl space, he begins to dismember Stephen Hicks's body, cutting the arms and legs off, then the head, before slicing the torso open, explored the intestines of Stephen Hicks, much as he had done with the dead animals he had found in the years gone by. Dahmer then placed the body parts into garbage bags. He left them there before leaving the crawl space and burning the clothing and any other piece of identification that Stephen Hicks had on him. Dahmer decides that he's going to dump the remains in a ravine about 10 miles from the house later that evening. This is at roughly 3 o'clock in the morning. Dahmer actually ends up getting pulled over by the police as he had been drinking, and the officer observed him crossing the double yellow line. The officer requests that Dahmer do a field sobriety test, which he amazingly passes. However, the first officer had called for backup, and as Dahmer is doing this field sobriety test, the man shines his flashlight into the back of the car, sees the large plastic bags, and gets an awful smell, asking Dahmer what is inside of the bags. Dahmer responds that it's the household trash. When the officers ask him why he's out so late getting rid of it at the dump, Dahmer lies, telling them that his parents were in the middle of a very messy divorce, and he was unable to sleep, so given all of this, he decided that it would be a good idea to go out and drive, as it might help clear his head a little, giving Dahmer a ticket for careless driver. The officers tell him to go home, which Dahmer does, placing the bags back into the crawl space. Before he leaves, however, he opens one of the bags and removes Stephen Hicks's head. Dahmer stated that he went into the house, into his bedroom, placed Hicks's head on the floor, and then masturbated over it. The following evening, Dahmer pulls the bags out of the crawl space and shoves them into a drainage ditch in the backyard of the house, covering them with dirt. Dahmer held on to Hicks's head for a few days, continuing his ritual over it until it had become so putrefied he could no longer keep it, at which point Dahmer throws the head down into this drainage ditch as well. Dahmer later said, quote, "That night in Ohio, that one impulsive night, nothing's been normal since then. It taints your whole life. After it happened, I thought that I'd just try to live as normally as possible and bury it. But things like that don't stay buried. I didn't think it would, but it does. It taints your whole life." However, Dahmer is not done with Stephen Hicks's remains. A few weeks after this, Dahmer digs up Hicks's body, removes the flesh from the bones, using acid that he had to dissolve the flesh before taking a sledgehammer to Stephen Hicks's remains, turning the bones into dust and throwing them into the woods. Dahmer would then take Stephen Hicks's necklace as well as the knife that he had used to dismember the man and toss them into a nearby river. A few months after this, in September, Lionel Dahmer and his then-girlfriend arrive at the house to discover that Jeff is alone. The two of them decide that since Joyce has absconded with David, they're going to move in, which, at least according to Dahmer, assuaged his fear and anxiety somewhat. We are going to end the episode at this point. It is still 1978. Jeffrey Dahmer is 18 years old. He has now committed his first murder. His father and the father's new girlfriend have moved back into the house, and the two of them are going to decide what Jeffrey is going to do with his life. I hope all of you have enjoyed this episode number 200. Again, thank you guys so much for your support over the last almost 5 years. It is greatly appreciated, and it is humbling that so many of you out there enjoy what I do and how I cover these cases. Until next time, stay morbid!